Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. The Dodgers went 3-3 last week and are now 60-32 with a 13.5 game lead in the NL West. I'm Jacob Birch. With me, as always, is Dodgers guru Eric Steven.
Hello. Yeah, I'm still kind of reeling from, well, hey, the All-Star break's here, so that's cool. But also, I was just wondering, when exactly did you see Yasiel Puig playing with no sleeves?
I think your tweet, I think I woke up late, opened my phone, and it was your tweet with that. I saw that the Reds were going to play with it, and I just assumed they with like undershirts, like a basketball jersey sort of.
Right.
No, sir.
Yeah, I was stunned. I saw the same thing. I saw pregame stuff. I'm like, that's cool, honoring Ted Kluszewski. And then like, and then once the game starts, they'll be like normal. And then I just happened to flip on MLB TV. Let me just check the Reds game. First batter, farmer's tan, shoulders like open. I was like, what the hell? And I'm like, wait a minute, the Reds have Yasiel Puig. I need to see this through. And then sure enough, he got a single in his first at bat. And I was like, well, I'm going to screenshot that. And I became my, I think it's my most popular tweet ever. Amazingly.
99% of the time, I love that Dodgers are this very traditional franchise. They never change the uniform outside of McCourt's weird no names on the back thing experiment. They don't really do things like this. But now, like, I want to see Cody Bellinger without sleeves.
Well, so the All-Star game has, they're doing sleeveless, but they're doing, it's traditional sleeveless, so there's going to be undershirts. But I think maybe after seeing that on Sunday, maybe some of the players will just go, you know what? We're going bare arms on Tuesday. We'll see how it goes. Or at least for the home run derby. You got to do that.
I'm not sure what uniform changes could change how well Cody Bellinger is hitting the ball. We've been doing this all podcast. We're going to be talking half the show about him, maybe a third of the show about him after this ad break.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
So we've started every episode this regular season with a Cody Bellinger pace update. We're going to do that again today, but you went on a deep dive on this week off of regular season baseball.
Yeah, I figured there's not a lot of stuff going on right now with the Dodgers. It's like the same kind of stuff. So I was like, well, let's see where Bellinger's at, like with his season. But we always start with the pace update. So just to give you an idea where he's at, he's on pace for 53 home runs, which is higher than it was last week. 125 RBIs, basically the same as he's been for about a month. But I went deeper. He's also on pace for 123 runs scored. The last Dodger with 120 runs scored in a season was Sean Green in 2001. 2001, yeah. But then the part that shocked me, when would you guess was the last time before Sean Green that someone on the Dodgers scored 120 runs? You didn't even have to name the player. Just pick a year.
Yeah, it feels like during that big Rookie of the Year streak, one of them had to have. So that would have been my guess, sort of early 90s.
How about Maury Wills in 1962? Yeah. Maury Wills in 1962 scored 130, and then nobody did. And nobody scored 120 until Sean Green in 2001. So, Tommy Davis also scored 120 in 1962. That Dodgers scored a bunch of runs that year. It was the first year at Dodger Stadium, and then it became a pitcher's park.
The fact that you were bringing it up, I knew it was in the 90s, but that would have been my guess. And then I assumed you were going to tell me someone in the infield, someone in the 70s did it.
It would have been funny if I said, like, oh, it was
no.
Gary Sheffield in 2000, you know, like 1 year before.
Weirdo?
Yeah, no, okay, so another pace for Bellinger. He's on pace for 387 total bases. there hasn't been a ton of guys get to 400. Like, that's like a huge thing. I think, like, I remember like Jim Rice did in like 1978, and that was like a huge deal. I think Pujols did it at least once. But the last Dodger with 350 total bases, do you have a guess for that?
And it wasn't Sean Green.
It wasn't Sean Green.
Didn't he do that in one game?
Yes, he had 340 total bases in one game, and then he hit two home runs the rest of the year.
Again, I would have probably defaulted to Piazza.
Okay, so not that far back, but
okay. Yeah.
Matt Kemp in his near MVP season 2011, 353. The LA Dodger record is Adrian Beltre in his 2004 season, 376. Bellinger's on pace for 387. The Dodger record, including Brooklyn, is Babe Herman in 1930, back when, like, if you think like the ball's like a Super Bowl now, like the offense was crazy in the 30s. Not so much necessary for home runs, but just all over the place. But he had 416 total bases in 1930. So that's the Dodger record.
So right now, do your absolute best to be objective. Is Cody Bellinger the NL MVP?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right now he is. It's really only him or Yelich at this point.
No, absolutely. I don't think there's anyone else in the conversation now.
And actually, like, it was funny, like, All-Star, everyone's doing All-Star stuff now. And MLB this morning just put out, like, three new ads. One of them has both Bellinger and Yelich. They both filmed independently at, like, their own ballparks. And they called it, like, Belly versus Yelly. And it's basically them playing a baseball version of horse. But instead of horse, it's MVP. And it's the rules are a little bit bastardized because it's not exactly horse. But it's like, oh, hit one in row seat 15 or something. And then they try to hit it. And then they just keep doing weird stuff. It's pretty funny, actually. The acting is terrible. But it's funny, like, just for a baseball ad, I guess. But pretty neat. But yeah, so it's those two. But for me, like, defense is what sort of sets them apart. The offense, they're, like, close enough.
Most, and they ebb and flow. Like, right now, Bellinger has a slight lead in most of the categories. Not all. Yelich is
first in some. Bellinger is first in some. And Bellinger is second in the ones Yelich is first in, or vice versa. Jeff McNeil's leading in batting average. But other than that, they're like 1-2 in almost everything. Bellinger leads in runs, total bases, OPS plus, wins run created plus, and then both wars. But the defense is why. But then he's second in batting average, on base, slugging, and OPS. So, you know, it's close. But yeah, like, looked at defense. Yelich is like average at best on most metrics, and below in quite a few. Bellinger's first in the majors among defensive runs saved among outfielders. He's plus 18. The next best outfielder in the majors is plus 11 in that category, Kevin Kiermaier. But then if you look at the StatCast stuff, on outs above average, Bellinger is plus 6. That's tied for 8th in the majors. The leader there is plus 11, which is Kiermaier. So it's like, but the point is Bellinger is very good. Bellinger also leads all major league outfielders in UZR, just ahead of Byron Buxton, to give you an idea of how good defensively Bellinger's been. Total zone rating doesn't rate Bellinger as high. He's only plus 1 there, but like he's at very worst an above average defender, but most metrics have him as like excellent. So that's really set him apart.
It was, so when Bellinger started playing in the outfield 2 years ago, the idea was, well, hey, this is great. If we have to, we can put in the outfield. Like if either right. back then it was Adrian Gonzalez, if you needed to stash someone in at first base, you could. And now it's like, no, we get to use him in the outfield. Let's put Jacques at first. We need to keep his glove in the outfield. It's so remarkable to me that in 2 years of how improved he is.
Right. And it's like, Bellinger can play in the outfield if he had to. He has speed. Also, he's like the fastest Dodger, like, you know, like, that's another thing. So StatCast has a thing that, you know, they use, you know, batted ball data. They measure like sprint speed and jump, outfield jump. And they have this little thing on every individual player page where it's like these little, sort of like, they're dials basically, and like imagine it's like from bad, bad on the left side, and if you're the very best at something, you're like all the way to the right. So it's almost like I guess a gas gauge in your car, right? And Bellinger's like on full for like everything. Like there's like eight categories. I screenshotted it the other day. And it's like, you know, exit velocity, expected this, expected that from hitting, and then like sprint speed, outfield jump, or, you know, like everything there is like, it's like if you maxed out a video game player, that's what Bellinger's playing this year. So it's kind of crazy.
And it's right, like, crazy for someone that came, again, came up as an, what we heard from him is a pretty good bat skills and an elite first baseman defensively. So you're thinking, oh, who knows how good his speed is and how good his arm is, because those aren't things you necessarily find in a first baseman. And oh no, they're elite too.
Right. He dabbled in the outfield the first 2 years of his career. Not dabbled. He ended up playing quite a bit. But he had three assists total in those 2 years. 873 innings this year. 656 innings so far in the outfield. He has eight assists. So, like, only Leury García of the White Sox has more with nine. So, Bellinger's been amazing. But you're right. It's like, yeah, he was a Gold Glove first baseman who could also play outfield if you had to. And now he's, like, indispensable Gold Glove outfielder, like, who's probably the fastest – one of the fastest guys in baseball. Like, think about this. Like, any ground ball he hits that's, like, to the left of second base, it's like – he might beat it out. Like that's how fast he is. Like, so or at least you're watching for that, you know, and like routine stuff, he makes it look very difficult for infielders to like get him out. So it's been kind of amazing.
And it's not just defensively. He's a completely different player offensively. He was always good, but he had clear holes that he just doesn't really seem to have anymore.
Right. Until the weekend, he was the only qualified hitter with at least as many or more walks than strikeouts. But now he's up to 56 strikeouts and 54 walks. So he's, how dare he, right? But like, it's still like compared to like his other seasons, like the ratio was way different. Like he had way more strikeouts and now he's much better. I think the thing that stands out, I guess, is his swing rate outside the strike zone. I was looking at Fangraphs on this. It was 29.1% last year, 28.6% in 2017. That's like percentage of pitches outside the zone that he swings at. This year, it's down to 25.3%. It doesn't seem like it's a big difference, but like it is. Like there's a lot of pitches like outside the zone, and if you're like if you let you know 4% of all those pitches go. That's you're taking more balls, you're taking more walks, but then it's forcing the pitchers to throw more strikes. And the results have been, you know, he's pounding those strikes. Like his exit velocity is like 2 miles an hour higher than his first 2 years. And then you look at all his like Statcast data, that means like all of his, he has like these gaudy numbers. He's hitting what, 336, 436 on base, 692 slugging. His expected slugging is 680. So he's not like, getting lucky. His expected batting average is actually 353, which is 17 points higher than his actual batting average. So if anything, given how hard he's hitting the ball, he should have a higher average than he does, which is kind of ridiculous. So it's been pretty crazy. He did hit a couple home run milestones this week. He hit the Dodgers had that they extended their walk-off streak to five straight home games with the first two games against Arizona, the first of which was they were down a run, and then it was two outs and 0-2 on Chris Taylor with two outs, nobody on. And so, like, that game was over, basically. Chris Taylor drew a walk, and then everybody else drew a walk. Five straight walks to end that game. Bellinger got the last one. And then the next night, Bellinger hit the walk-off home run. That gave him two in the game, 29 on the season, and then he hit another home run the next night. So he has 30. He has 30 home runs before the All-Star break. He's the first Dodger to do it. All-Star breaks are weird because they don't, you know, we always talk about first half, second half, but it varies. Like, there's not like a set amount of games every year before the All-Star break, and sometimes seasons start later and earlier and stuff. This year started in earliest it's ever started, so. The Dodgers played 92 games before the break this year. Some seasons are more. if you look at it, like he was in terms of fastest by team games to 30 home runs, he did it in 89 games. And then the other two, I wish I had it in front of me. I think it was Duke Snider and Gary Sheffield. They had 87 games and 88 games, but so just barely ahead of Bellinger. But like he's basically doing stuff that like basically like the best in franchise history at all these things. He already has more home runs than he had last year. He has 20 home runs at home. The Dodger Stadium record for a season is 23. So these things seem like they're going to like fall, like all these sorts of records. But you know, if you want to be a little bit of a wet blanket, you could say after the break last year, Bellinger hit 8 home runs. So like, it's not, you know, it could happen, but all we've talked about, like how he's sort of modified his approach, you know, solidified things, and he's just a much different, much better hitter now. So I do expect that, you know, the home runs can maybe not at the exact pace he's on, but he's still going to be like super productive, I think, in the second half.
So we've talked a lot about how he ranks amongst in Dodger history. Where does he rank sort of in Major League history? Where does this season rank?
Well, I mean,
from a guy that's both hitting the ball and playing defense so well.
Yeah, so he like at the moment he leads in Baseball Reference WAR and Fangraphs WAR. He's at 6.6 Baseball Reference and 5.7 Fangraphs. He's on pace for 11.6 Baseball Reference WAR. Like the highest is like 14, I think, from Babe Ruth. So like he's not going to be necessarily up there, but he's going to be like pretty ridiculous, like. In terms of like just I just had this in a Dodger perspective, like there's only been you know, like in the history of the Dodgers, they've only had 22 seasons of a position player getting 7 WAR. So he's already at 6.6. So like, you know, by the end of July he should be there. And then the highest the highest seasons are all sort of bunched up. It's basically like either Baseball Reference or Fangraphs is roughly the same. It's slightly different, but Baseball Reference says Jackie Robinson, 1951, he had 9.7 WAR. Adrian Beltre in 2004 had 9.6. Jackie Robinson, 1949, 2 years earlier than his other year, 9.6. The Fangraphs highest is Adrian Beltre in 2004, 9.7. That 49 Robinson year was 9.6. So these are all like basically there. So if Bellinger can get to like 10 WAR, he'd have the highest. And, you know, the caveat is if someone's like 0.1 away in WAR, they're basically tied. It's not a clear victory, but like, because these are, you know, more, I don't know, estimations is probably the wrong word, but it's, they're not like exact. I wouldn't have them as exact as the numbers make it seem, but the fact that he's on pace to like blow past those is kind of amazing. And like it would just be funny to see how high he gets up on the leaderboard when it's like August 15th or something. The way he's going, he could be like near the top of this list like within like a month and a half.
Just real quick, there have been using baseball refs war 20 seasons of 11 WAR or higher. So if you hit that, he is in extremely rarefied air.
That's pretty crazy.
Let's talk about another Dodger All-Star and everyone's favorite stat, WAR. Clayton Kershaw, kind of an honorific attendee to Cleveland this week. But, you know, you certainly could argue on merit this season he's not the most deserving, but certainly deserving of an All-Star, and has kind of earned his reputation. Where is he as he kind of enters the declining phase of his career WAR-wise?
So this kind of was brought to my attention because Gary Scott, friend of the show, friend of the site, and True Blue LA member, he sent me a tweet that said, "Are we going to have a party when Kershaw hit 64.5 Fangraphs WAR?" And I wasn't sure what he was talking about, but I looked, and Don Sutton is the all-time Dodger pitching leader in WAR with 64.4. Kershaw is at 63.7. So like, again, like this could be like a next month type of a thing, where he leads. Kershaw already leads in Baseball Reference pitching WAR. He's at 63.5 there. Dazzy Vance is 61.7, Don Drysdale 61.3. Those are the only three with 60 WAR from Baseball Reference. So Kershaw is already like cemented himself as, you know, one of the greatest pitchers in Dodger history, if not the greatest. I mean, you know, I think this is a generational thing. Like, there's a lot of arguments that say Kershaw is better than Sandy Koufax. Koufax had the performance in the World Series, so a lot of people aren't going to get past that, which is fine. People who saw Koufax pitch, like, would probably stab you in the eye if you suggested it wasn't Koufax. So I understand, but, like, I said, at the very worst, Kershaw's, like, the second best pitcher in Dodger history. So, but, like, he's also, like, doing other stuff. He's fifth right now in starts. He's at 331. He's already passed Fernando Valenzuela and Dazzy Vance this year. Brickyard Kennedy, 333. Claude Osteen, 335 are next. So, like, by sometime in August, Kershaw's going to be third all-time on the Dodgers in starts, like, in history. Now, he's going to be third for a while because Drysdale's fourth with 465 starts. So, that's a tall order. And then Sutton, number one, with 533. So, he's 30 behind Koufax for third in strikeouts in Dodger franchise history. He's sixth in wins with 160, five behind Koufax. So these are like things. He's going to like pass Koufax in a couple things this year, maybe. And then he's going to be the all-time Fangraphs war leader. I'm sure they're not going to stop the game once it happens. Like, I can just imagine that he gets to like 64 and a half war. And then like the game stops in like the seventh inning, and then someone comes out to the mound and they gets an ovation for his career war achievement. I doubt that's going to happen, but I'll be noticing.
We want to talk about one more, not Dodger All-Star, but Cleveland attendee right back after this break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So Jock Peterson is not an all-star, but he is in Cleveland, and he will be doing something today for potentially a lot of money.
That's right. The new
this little thing called the Home Run Derby. I act like this is a big secret. Sorry.
It's by the time this gets released, like the results are already
be a millionaire again.
Right, exactly. Again. So the winner now gets $1 million. This may have still been going on. I know they revised like the All-Star winners of the game get money for the All-Star game itself. But now for the Home Run Derby 2, the new format, this is the fifth year of it. It's pretty exciting. It's only eight players and it's bracket and it's timed. So like there's no, like the worst part about the Home Run Derby is when people start getting paid or hitters start getting patient and they're like, because it's just outs. Like, so if you swing and don't hit a home run, it's an out. And then, but if you let a pitch go by, wait for your pitch, and it's like a really bad slam dunk contest at that point. But this now with like a time thing, it's like you just got to hit home runs as fast as you can, and try to set a number or beat the number that is in front of you, and it makes for a pretty exciting thing to watch. But yeah, Jock Peterson is one of the eight. MLB did a weird thing where like they announced the official like field on ESPN. It was July 3rd, so like day before a holiday, and they announced it at like 10:30 Eastern time at night. So like the worst timing ever. Like I stumbled across it on ESPN, and they're like, oh, by the way, so and so's in the Derby, and they're like, wait, this is the announcement, and so. it was just a stunning display of like MLB not knowing what the hell's going on. But yeah, so he's one of the eight. He's matching up against Alex Bregman in the first round. Dino Ebel is the Dodgers' third base coach, is pitching to him. He's pitched in two other home run derbies. I think one of them was Vladimir Guerrero in 2007 when he won. And Vlad Guerrero Jr. is in this tournament. So it's going to be a fun little tournament, but we'll see how it goes. The other Peterson was in the Home Run Derby in 2015, the first year of this new format, and he was a rookie then. I looked up some stuff for like the pre-home run derby odds for like each of the last 5 years. And Peterson was actually tied for the best odds that year because he had such a hot first half. He had actually started to fade already. And then he really cratered in the second half. And everyone was like, well, he shouldn't have gone to the home run derby when that's never the case. But yeah, so he ended up, he was the four seed that year. They usually cut it off by, they rank it by home runs by a certain date. This year it was last Tuesday. So he's the four seed. Bregman's the five. Christian Yelich was the one seed, but he has a bad back. So he backed out. So now Matt Chapman is the one seed by default because they already set the seedings. So like, the jock side of the bracket could clear up really quick and he could just waltz to the final. We'll see. But no, 2015, he beat Manny Machado in round one. He beat Albert Pujols in round two. And then he lost to the hometown guy at the time, Todd Frazier, who was with the Reds then in Cincinnati. And that was a really exciting final. They've been all exciting. So it's going to be fun to see. It should be fun. Just before we started recording, they did like the All-Star press conferences and it became official. Hyunjin Ryu starting the Tuesday All-Star game, Justin Verlander for the American League. And another note, since Cody Bellinger starting, Robertson intimated that he would be in center field. Bellinger, he's actually going to start in right, and Ronald Acuna is going to be in center. So, but Bellinger's batting cleanup for the National League, which is the youngest All-Star lineup in history. I think they averaged just under 26 years, but he's the first Dodger cleanup batter in the All-Star game since Mike Piazza. 1997.
Mike Piazza is finally the
answer. So you were right. Exactly.
I was saving it. Yep. And we should also mention Max Muncy, All-Star.
That's right. He was named Anthony Rendon, I believe, is nursing some injuries or soreness. And he was named an All-Star for the first time. Rendon was, but he's not going to play. But Muncy was named as a replacement. And we talked about this last week. Muncy was, you know, very deserving, both from an offensive standpoint and a defensive standpoint. He's been kind of invaluable moving around, playing three positions. So good for him. Good story.
We have a lot of questions to get through, but I know you wanted to touch on interleague a little bit. You didn't tell me what. You just said, I want to talk about the interleague. And I said, okay, four questions. I'll let you.
Very vague. Yeah, no. So mostly because the Dodgers this week after the All-Star break, they play, they go to Boston first
I'll
time.
Be there.
That's right. Wait, which game are you going to? I forgot.
The first, Friday.
Oh, okay. So, like, it's funny. Like, all the games start at the same time for the most part, I think within 5 minutes of each other, because Friday's a normal game, you know, 7 o'clock local, and then Saturday's a Fox game nationally, and then Sunday's an ESPN game. So all the games are at 7, 4 o'clock Pacific, so going to be an interesting weekend. But, yeah, so interleague play is back. You know how there's an odd number of teams in each league, so there's always interleague play, but you know there's never a set time for it, so it just comes and goes. But I was going to talk about this a few weeks back with the when they played the Angels. I had some thoughts on it, but I think that was the week Seager got hurt, or I forgot if something happened before that it just kind of made it move. I didn't want to bog down the podcast, but it's really only like just a note. I always thought, if I had to change interleague play, I don't think it's going anywhere. Like I used to think like just get rid of it, you know. But I kind of like it. It's kind of cool. I like the aspect of I would have a more set, like defined thing where it ensured that teams you saw teams like every 3 years. So my thing is if this requires baseball to expand. So logistically, this could be like a nightmare, but if you expand two more teams, like who knows when this would happen, but this is my ideal plan. I think I wrote about this. I swear to God, I can't find it, but I wrote about this as a junior in high school. So this would have been like 1993 for Mr. Caudill's English class. I forgot the exact assignment, but it was like make a proposal or something. And my proposal was like how to realign baseball. And like I had interleague play as part of my This was before interleague play, so like I think they were talking about it at the time. So it's not like I invented it, but wait, you know what? I did. No, so I would go to 32 teams, 16 in each league, four divisions in each league. So the winners of the four divisions go to the playoffs. No wild cards. Realistically, this is never going to happen, but because the wild card's so popular. But I think this would be a fair way to do it. But so my schedule, you'd play in your own division, you'd play those three teams 22 times. So that's 66 games, 11 at home, 11 away every single year. If you look at the same league, there's 12 other teams in the three other divisions. You play those teams one series at home, one series away every year. That's six games each. That's 72 games. So that leaves 24 games for interleague play. And it alternates divisions every year. You play the same thing, home series and a road series every 4 years against the team. So the NL West 1 year would get the AL West, and then the next year would get the AL Central, and then, you know, whatever the divisions are. But so that's 24 games. So that way, teams in like Seattle, you'd get to see the Dodgers every 4 years. Same with the Dodgers getting to see the Mariners every 4 years. That's the only thing I thought about. I have no, like, I don't think this will ever happen, but because I think like the wild card is there to stay. So there's probably going to be some, if they ever realigned or did something like that, it would be more radical, I think, where it would almost be like just a conference setting or something, where then they'd have the top certain number of teams make it, and there'd probably still be wild cards, but who knows how they'll do it. But that's just my thought for sort of equalizing. And making sure everyone sees a team every 4 years. Because right now the Dodgers they haven't been to Boston since 2010. So, you know, I'd like to rectify that. Like they should go to Yankee Stadium every 4 years. They should go to Fenway Park every 4 years, something like that. So that's how I would sort of switch it up.
Twitter questions. We haven't had Twitter questions in a while. Are you excited?
Yeah, I am. I put out a lob for questions and got a decent, response.
Darian asks, how far do the Dodgers get with the current bullpen?
So my snark answer to this is like a couple weeks, because it's going to be like pretty different. I think they're like clearly going to trade for a reliever or two. They actually already traded for one, Casey Sadler. They got from the Rays, but he's like, they already optioned him to AAA. But like, just to put this in perspective, like last year, Dylan Floro was kind of the same, like unheralded type pickup. I'm not saying he's going to be as good as Dylan Floro has been, and Dylan Floro has been struggling this year. So it's not like he's some like ideal, but like that, they're just going to keep adding. And like right now he's in AAA Oklahoma City, but, he's more of a bulk guy, Sadler is, but I think could be useful. He actually got a 3-inning save in his first game with Oklahoma City, so I like that. I like Casey Sadler's story. I was reading up a little about him. He's like from Florida, and he has a wife and a 2-year-old daughter, and he wanted to spend more time with them. I think in 2018 he decided this, so he started. They bought like a camper, and then the family like basically trails him during the season in AAA. And they just live in the camper, like wherever they're playing. And so he got called up to the majors this year in April. And then he drove from like Durham to like their house in Florida, Bradenton, I think. And it was like a 15 and a half hour drive for him to get like his major league call up this year. He's been up and down in previous seasons, played with the Pirates too. But yeah, so it should be interesting. I don't expect he's going to be the savior. But you know, we talked about this before. They've been linked to all the big names like Will Smith, Felipe Vasquez with the Pirates. They'll probably be in on Brad Hand. We'll see how that goes. But and then the other thing is, you know, what if they go get a starter? Then that means like Urias stays in the bullpen for a while. I think he's going to stay in the bullpen for a while anyway. But like, just I'm thinking of like October here. If Urias is in there, Maeda's eventually going to go to the pen. So he's in there, like, so it's just a matter of, like, mixing and matching. It really depends what they do with July 1st, 31st, but I think they're going to be very active this month, and that's going to be where they sort of, you know, make those additions.
But let's humor me here. Let's say randomly they add either effectively by trading for a starting pitcher or by trading for additional actual relievers. What does the shape of this bullpen look like to you? They've been getting better. They still, I wouldn't call them great. Joe Kelly has been doing the Joe Kelly thing where he's shown flashes of greatness with random, you know, let's give up five runs. But he's been seeming to oscillate towards what the Dodgers are paying him for. Do you see him still? Does Joe Kelly remain in the bullpen? What names are you excited to bring to the postseason roster with who they have now?
So I think unless he like completely sucks the last couple months, I think Joe Kelly's like a lock for the postseason. I mean, that's a stretch probably to say, but like they're like gradually getting him in like higher leverage games. And like the joke is like, I mean, I like Joe Davis and Hershiser a lot, but it's like, man, you don't have to carry water for the org all the time. Sometimes, you know, It seems a little much. And then like every time Joe Kelly would come in and be like, well, his ERA is 6, but man, he has great stuff. You know, it's like, you don't have to like stick up for him every single time. That said, this last like week or so, or maybe a little longer than that, the stuff has really played up. Like he has looked, you know, noticeably better. We'll see. He has to still, you know, perform to like earn that right. But I think, you know, we'll see. But yeah, I think so. You know, Jansen's the obvious. I think Kelly will be there. Baez is going to be there for sure. And then it's like a crapshoot. They'll figure out a left-hander. Like, I think Caleb Ferguson has been up and down, but he has the stuff to like be there, but we'll see. I think ideally, like, Urias is probably in the pen for them. The only problem is he's not much of a back-to-back guy. So you almost have to like plan a two-outing thing for him or two-inning thing for him or something. And then you can't use him for like two games. So this really depends on who's starting. Like if they had a starter, they don't need to move Urias in the rotation in October. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen. There's a lot between now and then. But also, I think Maeda's going to end up in the bullpen in October, and he's always been like death on righties. So I think we'll see. So the Dodgers this year in 2019, they're actually strangely eighth in the major leagues in bullpen ERA, 4.05. So not great, but like the Indians are number one at 3.48. So, you know, bullpens have been kind of struggling. If you look at just FIP, fielding independent pitching, you know, batted ball stuff, home runs, walks, strikeouts, they're 4.24. That's 13th. So, like, I think they're more toward middle of the pack than necessarily above average. But, and that's with, like, getting a little better, gradually better as we go. But they still need improvements in terms of, like, who can you trust.
On that, one thing that I don't – it would take an injury to change this is Kenley Jansen's going to be the Dodgers' closer. And in this year of the home run that the baseball is having, how concerned does that make you?
I mean, he's
certainly – he's certainly a good relief pitcher, but has he been – closer-worthy this year?
Well, like – I don't think there's anyone on the market like who they would get.
Sure. I can fully admit this is not a problem that's going to get solved. This is what's going to happen. Kenley is your closer. But this year, for the first year in a while, first year ever, that makes me going into it nervous.
I think you just have to live with the fact that he's probably going to give up a few home runs, and you just work your way through it, you know? Like, it just is. Like, so I guess Felipe Vasquez has the most, like, what, closing experience. He or, like, Brad Hand would be the best, like, relievers they can get to be, like, if Kenley is unavailable or struggling, we could actually turn to this guy to close if we had to. But other than that, like, you just got to ride him out, I think. But yeah, I think that's just like more a part of his game now. But I think they talked about this too earlier this year, where they're trying to work in other pitches, like his slider, where it's not cutter, cutter, cutter all the time. And then if the cutter's not working, you're kind of screwed. So I think he's working on other things, but, you know, we'll see.
Luis Verduzco has a couple of questions. First one, I think, kind of straightforward. What are the chances that Jimmy Lewis signs with the Dodgers?
Yeah, so he was the pick at the end of the second round for the Dodgers for compensation for losing Grandal as a free agent. So correct me if I'm wrong. I should have checked back with David Hood on this, but he seemed to think, like, you know, Lewis would probably sign.
That seems right. I seem to recall that.
So we'll find out this week, because the deadline is July 12th, which is Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. So he has a commitment to LSU. The Dodgers have basically signed everybody, at least with the slot value, and then based on other bonuses, they are you can go like up to a dollar less than 5% over and just get charged like a money penalty, an overage penalty. But if you go, if you reach the 5% mark, you start to lose future draft picks. And so far, like, no team in the draft has done this since they instituted this. So that's effectively the limit. So the Dodgers right now, I think there are, his slot value where his pick was is $793,000, but with the amount that they're under now, based on other bonuses, and then the fact that they can go up almost to 5% over, they have roughly $1.45 million to spend on him. So he was the 78th pick. If you looked at, like, the actual slot values of other picks, like, that $1.45 million is, like, about pick 50 or 51 money, which is, like, top 10 in the second round, and it's almost a full round higher than what he actually went. So, I mean, if that doesn't get it done, I don't know what will, but that's kind of where they're at. It seems like something that would get done, but you never know. That seems like a good amount of money to sign him, but, you know, some people have different expectations, but we'll see.
Last Twitter question, again from Luis. Do you think the Dodgers brought up Beedy, Rios, Garlic, and Gonsolin to showcase them to other teams and maybe as trading chips?
I don't think so. I see this question a lot, people mention it a lot. I just don't think that happens like a ton. Like, scouting is good. There's a lot of video too, and teams have a pretty good idea of who players are. And I don't think, like, if the Dodgers were like, man, we gotta bump up Edwin Rios' trade value. Is Edwin Rios getting, like, you know, 12 at bats over like 3 weeks? Is that going to really, like, sway the matter? Like, oh man, he hit a triple. Like, man, I totally want to trade for him now. Like, I just don't think that stuff matters a ton. They called those guys up because they needed bench help. And, you know, Pollock is down, Seager was down, David Freese got hurt. All of them are coming back for, like, the Boston series, by the way. As we're recording today, David Freese was actually activated today. They don't play till Friday, but they optioned Rios and Garlic to Oklahoma City. So the expected move is going to be optioning Matt Beattie as well, and then activating both Pollock and Seager. Both of them are still on rehab assignments, so I think they're playing Monday and Tuesday, or at least until Tuesday. That's right, Amy Mann's going to be there. But they, you know, it's expected that both those guys will be back, but Beattie will probably be back in AAA too. But yeah, I just think it was more need-based than anything, and those were the next guys up on the line. It had more to do with what they needed on the field rather than trying to showcase them, in my opinion.
We've got a couple of emails full of questions to answer after this ad break. Okay, we got a couple of questions from Sissy that she sent to us in an email. First question is, will Seager's injuries hurt his career overall in things like all-star appearances, Hall of Fame, trade, or free agent value?
I mean, he's only 25, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to say, like, I don't like. I'm not thinking Hall of Fame. I look. He had as good of a start as almost any Dodger. He was what top three MVP in his first year, All Star for 2 years, like basically upper echelon player in the National League. Both seasons, and he got hurt, but he had like major surgery. So
yeah,
it's the thing I'm like bullish on is like he was hitting before he hurt his hamstring this year. So I'm less. There was always the apprehension of, wow, well, his elbow was hurt. Was he going to get his power back? But he's like booming doubles again and hitting enough home runs to matter. So that was fine for me. Now, like, hamstrings are a different issue. And like we saw with like Matt Kemp, once he started getting hamstring injuries, he started getting more hamstring injuries, and it just like hurt. But part of that was like Kemp was also like getting more and more out of shape. Especially and after he moved on to like San Diego and Atlanta. But I don't know if that's the case with Seager. You know, he's on the no dairy team. So like they're not worried about that with him, at least for now. But in terms of the other stuff, so before his Tommy John surgery, he played in or the Dodgers had 381 games from his September call up in 2015 to the time he went on the DL in 2018, he played in 355 of those, 93%. It's a 151 game pace. He started 333. That's 142 starts on average per 162. So that's like an everyday player. Like, you know, there's no 162s really anymore. But so he's as regular as you can get. And then like he basically did the same this year before his hamstring. So like, in terms of like where, like he's just going to play every day unless he's hurt. And like, I think he's going to still put up numbers, but like, you know, he's got a long way to go, a little bit, you know, more to go before like free agency. So I don't know. I don't have any inside information on this, but the Dodgers really haven't signed any of their guys to like extensions early or anything like that. At least at this point, in their careers. So it's not something that's on the radar for me right now. But yeah, hope he'll come back from hamstring injury and I think he'll produce, but we'll see.
Her next question, what was the earliest point in the season that the Dodgers have been able to clinch a division?
Okay. So there's two sort of answers. This one, since moving to LA, if you go by games in the season, 1977, they clinched in game 151. So with 11 games left in 2013, they clinched in game 153. But that was the earliest date. That was September 19th, whereas 1977 was September 20th. So I'd probably go with 77 just based on team games, but the earliest, like in franchise history, was in Brooklyn in 1955. That was the year they started out 22-2, just a crazy great year. The Dodgers clinched on September 8th of all times, game 138. So they had 16 games left. They had a 17 game lead. They beat Milwaukee that day, which gave them a 17 game lead with 16 to play. So that was very, very early.
Can this team do it?
September 8th? Hell no. That's like too early. Like they, you know, it's 13 and a half now. If we, I know we've talked about this because Craig has asked us previous podcasts, but I think we had settled on somewhere between either 14 or 15 game lead at the break. And like they lost their last three. And it probably would have been around then if they didn't lose those last three. But that's sort of the point. It's hard to go through a whole season without losing three in a row at one point. So, yeah, 13 and a half is huge. But even if they, like, keep that up, if they add to it, you're still looking at, like, 2 weeks left in the season. Or maybe, like, that like a September teen number. But not September 8th. September 8th is far too early.
It'll be interesting to see how the Dodgers handle this large lead and if they do clinch even 2 weeks early, if not earlier, because with the World Series now being dictated by overall record, you have to think that's something they would really, really like to keep considering how well this team is playing at home.
Yeah, I would say that. And then, like, they are, they have a, like, a, I think it's what, 5.5? Yeah, 5.5 game lead in the National League. And then if you go by, in the American League, it's actually like, it's, well, my brain stopped working. It's only a game over the Yankees. The Yankees have played 2 fewer games than the Dodgers. They have 3 fewer wins, but 1 fewer loss. So it's a little tricky, but, they're kind of more bunched up with the Houston, the Twins and the Yankees. So it'll be tougher.
Well, we end the show, as we often do, for any new listeners, True Blue LA contributor, friend of the show, friend of the site, and most importantly, friend of your mine, Craig Manami sends us 5 questions every week, usually 1 food question snuck in there and the bunch of baseball questions. You ready? All right, the first question, baseball question. How many games out would you two consider as the time for a team to start selling? In the AL, there are 3 teams within 3 games of a wild card spot. In the NL, there are 6 teams within 2.5 games. The Giants, who we sort of label as the sellers of the market right now, are only 5.5 games out of a wild card, but would obviously also need to pass a bunch of teams to get there.
Yeah, like the NL is weird right now. There's like, it's like the Dodgers and the Braves are good, and then somehow the Cubs and Brewers are like messing around, and they're like not distancing themselves from anyone, and like everyone else sucks, and like everyone else sucking except for the Marlins, who are terrible, like means that everyone still technically has a chance. But I think the Giants are garbage. They have to be realistic. I know they're only 5.5 out of wild card, too many teams in front of them, terrible run differential. So you obviously don't you play it out a little bit, but they're clearly sellers still. Because even if they like go on a super hot streak, they're not doing anything. So they're clearly sellers. I think you have to be realistic on this. If you're like the Pirates are like probably the team, and maybe the Reds, like the Reds should be better. Like weirdly, their pitching has been like decent and their offense has been just so bad in that ballpark, which is weird. I think maybe they, and then plus they played a sleeveless game and they lost 11-1. So like, how did that not turn things around for Cincinnati? Like, the NL Central, that's the weird division because the Reds are in last place. They're 41-46, but they're 4.5 games out of first. So like, that's the anything that could happen division, I guess. But, I don't know. I still, just based on how Cincinnati's played, I would still peg them as sellers. Pirates are like that borderline thing where you'd think they could contend, but they like their ownership's weird. Like they could have like committed more money like in the off season to do things, and they're like semi competing almost in spite of themselves. But I don't know if it's real competing, so I don't know. Like I it's hard to sell that to a fan base. So I don't want to just say you just got to give up. So if there's an actual chance, they're only 2.5 games out of first right now. So they can't really sell like full force. But I think if a trade came along that would help them long term, I think they should do it. But yeah, it's tough. The Mets are bad. They're 40-50. Just an absolute mess. They have to sell regardless of what, you know, their manager thinks. But I, you know, that's a, the Wilpons still own them, so like who knows? Good luck predicting what they're gonna do. The Phillies are like in contention, but like also been very inconsistent. So I have no idea. But yeah, I you know, you don't want to give up on your fan base, basically. But at the same time, gotta be realistic about these things. Like, so I'd lean towards selling in a lot of these places, but it's easy for me to say from afar, and it's much tougher to like actually implement that plan.
We talk a lot about sort of the Moneyball revolution and how every team has a sort of stats group that can run player simulations and try to evaluate players that way. One of the bread and butters things for those groups to do is to come up with playoff odds and stuff. 538 has their own. So they have the Giants at a 1% chance to make the playoffs. So that's the team I would look towards. more, almost more than anything else, that they can kind of get an idea of how the season's probably going to go. So you're looking at the Mariners, Giants, White Sox, Blue Jays, Marlins, Royals, Tigers, and Orioles all have 1% or less to make the playoffs. And then you have the next team after that is the Padres with 8%. So I think any of those teams in that 1% shot, you're pretty safe to do so.
But honestly, like I would say, like if you're like 20, you should still sell.
Probably, you know? Yeah. But yeah. If you wanted to like wait more towards the deadline, you probably are safe to do so. Yeah. And, you know, see what shakes up.
But yeah, the 1%ers right now, like shop's open, man. Yeah. Like you start selling off everybody.
The Dodgers have had at least four players with five or more stolen bases in every season from 95 to last season. So far, the 2019 Dodgers only have two players with more than five, Cody Bellinger and Chris Taylor. Besides Alex Verdugo and Max Muncy, each of whom Alex has three, Max has two, who do you think might steal a few more bases to get to five or more? I don't think it's happening.
Well, Verdugo has four and Muncy has three.
No, oh, I can't read stats apparently.
No, so that's all right. So, I mean, Muncy's still like a, you know, more of a sneaky guy. You got to think Verdugo gets there because he only needs one.
Mm-hmm.
Barnes has two, but like, can you steal second base from the bench? So like, you know, who knows? Kiki has two, but he did those both in the same game against Madison Bumgarner, and he hasn't stolen otherwise. So that's a tough sell. Maybe they weirdly trade for Rajay Davis to upgrade the bench, and then he ends up like leading the team with like 19 steals in a bench role. But no, other than that, yeah, that's a tough call. I think they get to three, but four is a tough sell.
Chris Taylor is the only Dodger position player to have at least one sacrificed bunt this season. If that holds, this will be the first season with just one position player with a sack bunt. Given the way the Dodgers play, would you expect another position player to get a sacrifice bunt? And if so, who?
Russell Martin is going to sacrifice bunt on August 18th.
Oh, wow.
Actually, I'm going to double check if they actually have a game on that date. That was the first thing that popped into my head. They play at the Braves on Sunday. Oh, yeah. Getaway day. You want to get out of there? Sacrifice all the way, baby.
I don't see it happening.
Yep.
So, yeah. No.
All right.
Last baseball question. Oh, no. It's not a baseball question. Haha. I can't really answer this. I spent the earthquake on Thursday night sitting in my car in the driveway. And as I thought about it later, the car was parked next to a multi-decade-old brick chimney. So probably not the brightest thing to do. Anything pop into your memories about earthquakes as this last week took place?
Craig was in a death trap. we had two earthquakes, two big ones. Like
what?
I always used to joke because I grew up in Palm Springs, basically mm-hmm. like, which is right on the San Andreas Fault, or you know, very near it. And like, the big quake in Southern California was the Northridge quake in mm-hmm. like '94. I don't remember feeling that in Palm Springs, but it used to sort of joke that like, if it's not like a six or higher, like I'm not even getting out of bed, you know, cause, but yeah, it's a stupid talk, but like, I felt a lot of earthquakes like when I was younger. But like, it seems like we haven't had a large one in a while. And the one on, I guess it was Thursday, July 4th. That was ended up being a 6.4. And then like, that was a big one. That one's in like near Bakersfield, I guess, or somewhere up there, which is like probably 120 miles from where I'm at. But people were feeling that like in Vegas. And like, I knew that was big because it just started rolling here and I'm on a second floor apartment. And it was like, okay, this is, oh, we're having an earthquake. Oh, wow, it's still going. Okay, oh, this is weird. And then, like, I was, like, sitting in my chair. I'm like, should I do something? I need to get up right now, don't I? But, like, it wasn't so bad, but, like, things were rocking. And then I was like, okay, that was something. I haven't felt one like that in a while. But it wasn't, like, unpleasant. Nothing unsafe here. But then the one the next night was at 7-1. And, you know, like the difference between like 6-4 and 7-1 is like exponential. So it's not like they weren't close. Like, and for me, like this wasn't like necessarily more violent, but I felt it more. And it was like, it seemed like it was twice as long. And that's how I knew it was going to be a huge one, because we just kept rolling. And like my, the one monitor that's on my desk outside of my laptop, it was like, it almost fell. And like, I mean, and this is all relative damage. We didn't really suffer any injuries or damage or anything like that, but it, I knew it was big just because it was so crazy. But like, I noticed the next day, one of my picture frames on the wall fell off the wall. I didn't notice it the night of, but I noticed it the next day. So like, I must've been paying attention to something else. It wasn't like this huge thing, but I did update my emergency kit in my car. I got like a new like first aid survival-y type thing with like a flashlight and a knife and all that kind of good stuff, and all the first aid stuff. And then also I even got like these, I forgot what they're called, like the little like, you know, dehydrated meals, or like there, it's like a, it's almost like a protein bar consistency, but it's like supposed to be a meal and they last for like 5 years. So that, those sitting in the back of my car. Now, the only thing I didn't add yet was getting water. And so I'm going to add that to my little emergency bag, but now it made me more prepared for if a truly like catastrophic one strikes.
Only a couple notes for me. I was very close to the epicenter for Northridge. So we really felt that. That was my only, I'm afraid for Thane's earthquake experience.
I had.
Everything else was almost fun, you know, like, yeah. Like, oh, it's kind of weird. There's this thing with earthquakes where even the most ardent, I'm only on Twitter because I have to be, I hate social media, but if you feel an earthquake in LA, you have to tweet about it. It's just, it's a law. And so I moved to Kansas City about 7 years ago, 8 years ago. And I'm like, I'm free of this. And then, is 2-3 years ago, there was a earthquake in Oklahoma, right on the Missouri-Oklahoma border. And I'm working at like 11 at night and I see a quick jolt and then the roll, meaning, you know, it's, I'm like, oh, this is like a five. I immediately thought, oh, this must be a five and it's like 200, 300 miles away. And I'm like, wait, I don't live in LA anymore. That's really strange. And then sign on, Facebook, I guess, and there was every person I know in the Lawrence, Kansas City area just ready to show. Was that an earthquake? And there it was. So I had one here.
I have to admit, I think both earthquakes, I tweeted something, but I believe I can't remember if it was the first one or second one, but a warning, explicit tag. I believe I tweeted, holy shit, that's a big one. Like, you know, just sort of, it was just the first thing that came to my mind. I don't know why I felt need to share that, but I did. The one thing I do remember about growing up too, we did have earthquake drills in school we would absolutely. Like, you know, yeah, I do remember that. So yeah, that was something.
Get on your desk, hold your head.
Yep. Just push everyone out of the way and run outside screaming.
Do you have a preference? Here's the food question. To a fried chicken wing seasoned with a dry rub or fried first? Or do you like to have sauce applied afterward?
I'm fine with dry rub, but for the most part, I think I lean always toward the sauce afterwards and toss.
I'm not a big fried chicken fan. I like it okay, but my wife, it's like her favorite thing. Her favorite thing is fried chicken. Yeah. And not really for me.
Fried chicken is delicious.
It's good.
But yeah, so like, yeah.
I've been a big fan of the Nashville hot chicken craze that's taken over major metropolitan areas. I like, give me a heat with like sort of coleslaw, maybe a nice sort of creamy sauce on top of that. I'm into that.
Yeah, I can get with that. But yeah, if it's just fried chicken, like, I don't like it. I mean, that's different. Like, you season that or you just cook it how you cook it. But like, if you're talking wings, I got to go toss it in sauce rather than dry rub.
Well, that's this week's episode. We're not doing one next week because I will be in New England, but I'll have a story from Fenway, and I think, and this isn't locked yet, but I think I'm going to be able to go to Cooperstown as well.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Nice. With former Angels PR man for 40 years, Tim Mead, now the president of the Hall of Fame.
I'll ask for him personally.
You should. He's like one of the nicest dudes ever.
True Blue LA podcast.
Just drop my name. He will just do everything for you. Yeah,
that's
right.
Great.
That's awesome. I hope you have a great time, whether you go to the Hall of Fame or not. But Fenway should be cool. Have you ever been to Fenway?
I have been outside of it, but it was I think they were in Baltimore that week, so I couldn't go to a game.
Cool. So yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Enjoy the All-Star game. And we will talk to you after the second half starts.